As I announced last week, starting in September, we're going to be entering into a congregational consultation about clarifying what the mission of this church might look like in the near future. And I think this promises to be a really exciting time for us, and I'm really looking forward to being part of the conversation about where God might be leading us, certainly in the short term. What that outcome might be is honestly is a mystery to me. But like you, I know I'm holding a piece of this puzzle, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the larger picture might look like as we start to try to put all of our separate pieces together. Because God's got something in mind. Now, as I've looked at the biblical texts for the remainder of this month, I can see that there are some things that will be bubbling up that I suspect will help us kind of prime the pump a bit, that will help us to, in our thinking about things that will be useful for us in the months ahead as we start to make some decisions. And oddly, this morning, it begins by reflecting on, at least at the beginning, about the issue of nature versus nurture. I mean, how much are we all a product of our upbringing, and how much are we a result of our DNA, of our genetic wiring? One of the ways these questions are sometimes researched is, of course, by looking at twins, particularly identical twins who are raised apart, which, of course, is no small challenge, because separating children at birth strictly for the purpose of research is really an ethical bridge too far. You wouldn't do that. But sometimes circumstances can cause this to happen, and the results are intriguing, and they suggest that our genetic makeup might have more influence than we think, or not. One of the most famous cases, I think, is that of Jim Lewis and Jim Springer. They are identical twins who were separated 3 weeks after their birth in 1940. And they were adopted into different families. And 39 years later, they were able to meet, and they discovered this long list of similarities. These separated, identical twins came to the attention of a University of Minnesota psychologist whose name was Thomas Bouchard. You can readily find this online. Bouchard was researching in this particular field, and he discovered some remarkable, and I would actually say kind of bizarre things. I mean, first of all, these kids separated at 3 weeks were given names by their adoptive parents, and they both named them Jim. They both grew up with dogs named Toy. When they went to school, they both preferred math and carpentry and disliked spelling terribly. Both were married twice. Both of their first wives were named Linda. Both of their second wives were named Betty. Both had sons they named James Allen, though they spelled Allen differently. They had the same job. They were both deputy sheriffs. They drove the same kind of car. They drank the same kind of beer. Interestingly, they were each told by their respective parents when they were growing up that they were twins, but they honestly believed that the other had died at birth. And both of them claimed that throughout their lives, until they met one another, they had this continuing sense of emptiness. Something was missing from their lives. It's strange, isn't it? Of course, our scripture reading today is about twins. But our twins today are about as different as chalk and cheese. And to make some sense of this story, just as it was a couple of weeks back when we wrestled with the account of Abraham's near sacrifice of his son Isaac, we always need to remember the back story. And that back story begins in Genesis 12 with God's promise to Abraham and Sarai to bring forth from them a great nation through whom the whole world would be blessed. And much of the biblical story flows out of that story. And it provides so much drama. The way the promise unfolds is a remarkable story. And the way Abraham and Isaac and Jacob attempt to bring this promise that was made to the family to fruition is absolutely fascinating. It's especially fascinating when they try to help God along a little bit when they don't really know what's going to happen next. So, some first thoughts for us to remember as we attempt to chart the next portion of this congregation's life. Let us hear and remember the promise. Let us play our required parts, no more but no less. And let's trust that God will do what God's promised. God will do what God's promised. What's needed, God will provide in God's time. So, as we look back at the previous 13 chapters, we can see that God has been quite faithful, giving Abraham and Sarah the son Isaac, even though it took them much, much longer than either of them would like. And then Isaac and his wife Rebekah joined in the waiting game. Years passed before they were gifted with children. And in fact, we learn in verse 26 of today's Genesis reading that it was a full 2 decades that they had to wait. And while it was a long delay, eventually Rebekah did become pregnant, and with twins at that. But what a pair they were. Even in the womb, they were combative. They were competing. Our text says that they struggled together within her. So they were kind of jostling in utero. Another thought to keep close. God will sometimes choose to use conflict to advance his purposes. Not all conflict is of God, of course. But sometimes it can play an important role in moving God's story along. Not surprisingly, this prenatal combat alarmed Rebekah. And so she asked God what was going on. And God responds in verse 23 saying, "Two nations are in your womb, two peoples butting heads while still in your body. One people will overpower the other, and the older will serve the younger." And really, this is a hard message on so many levels. It prophesies a tumultuous time to come. It speaks of dueling sons. That would alarm any parent, or it certainly would with me, because civil wars are often the nastiest kind of combat. But it wouldn't surprise me if what she stumbled over most was actually the last line. The older would serve the younger. This is actually the first reference in the Bible to the law of primogeniture. Oh, it's been great. A few weeks ago we had perichoresis, and then we had schadenfreude, and now primogeniture. What a great word. But it was believed that this was a commonly held custom in the Middle East at that time. It's been that way in a number of cultures. That a key part of the social order was the practice of the firstborn male child inheriting a substantial portion of the family estate. Perhaps twice the amount of the other children. And with the passing of the father, that son would then also have some sort of status as the head of the family. Now, interestingly enough, in the biblical story, God is always turning that around, but that's a whole other sermon. But that's the law of primogeniture. Firstborn son inherits the most, becomes the head of the family. And so Rebekah must have known that this was going to be a difficult time, because this was a hint that one of the most important elements of what kept the society glued together, this rule of inheritance, was about to be undercut. And that perhaps doesn't sound like too much to us, but then and there, this was a really, really big deal. And as we read on in the passage, we can see that this prophecy was all too accurate. Now, I have spent a bit of time working in the delivery room, and in my former occupation, I have seen all sorts of fascinating stuff. But you know, this birth was memorable. This is one that the doulas will be talking about for weeks after. Out pops the firstborn, Esau. And he's a rather interesting little character. Now, as those of you know from my own family situation, I have something of a soft spot for redheads. I'm married to a redhead, Subsequently, we have a son who's also a ginger. Before it started growing in white, not just gray, white, my beard was distinctly reddish. So red hair is near and dear to me. But I got to tell you, looking down as Rebecca did and seeing that my firstborn child was covered in red hair would scare the pants off me. Which raises another important question. Is a preacher allowed to say, scared the pants off you? And you'll tell me after. But to make matters even more strange, he's only barely ahead of his twin brother in the delivery. In fact, his brother Jacob's attempting to hang on to his brother's foot as he's being born. And it's like Jacob is trying to be born first. He's trying to climb over his brother mid-delivery. Because remember, being first out offers considerable advantage. It's the law of primogeniture, the importance of being the firstborn son. And you don't have to be some sort of psychotherapist to start thinking that there may be just a bit of sibling rivalry going on here. It's a foreshadowing of what's to come in the story. And you got to know that both Rebecca and Isaac are wondering what they've gotten themselves into now. I mean, they just wanted to have a good life, right? They just wanted to have children. They wanted to have the hope of a family and a future, because remember, they'd been promised a future. But this was so different than they'd expected. It was really complicated. It had all these bumps along the way, and it was hard. At times it hurt, and it hurt a lot. Sure, they had a life and they had a future, but it wasn't quite the future they had in mind. Does that sound familiar to anyone here? How many of us really have the life we expected? For most of us, things turn out significantly different than we planned, right? If you told any of us 40, 30, or even 20 years ago that believing that the church was a good thing for Canadians was a minority position in our country, that believing church was a good thing for Canadians is a minority position in our country, we would have been shocked. But that's true. Most people in the country aren't especially convinced that a church is necessarily a good thing. That's one of the results of a recent poll done by the United Church Observer. And so, if you go to our church Facebook page or you go to our website, you'll see a link to that. And there's all sorts of surprising information about what Canadians are thinking about organized religion. And boy, has our country changed. Things have turned out much different than I expected. Probably you too. Rebecca and Isaac, they wanted a child, and God be praised. I mean, they got two. But it wasn't quite the ride that they expected, because even with the promise of God, and perhaps especially in the promise of God, there are always surprises and twists and turns that will baffle us. So, we got these twin boys, but they are by no means identical twins. As I said earlier, different as chalk from cheese. And Esau, well, Esau is a bit of an oddity. He's got this red hair thing happening. And in that time and place, red hair would probably be a little unusual, I would think. But by the way, Esau means, are you ready? Andy? Hairy. I'd like you to meet my boy Harry. No, not Harry. Harry. I think naming a child that would severely burden a kid, but that's just one man's opinion. Anyway, we learn that Esau is the foreparent, the first of what are called the Edomites. And Edom is actually a word that sounds a lot like the Hebrew word Adam, which coincidentally means red. The reds. Anyway, as we read in the story, we learn that he grew up to be a first-rate hunter. Some describe as a man of the field. He was an outdoorsman. Someone you'd want to be lost with. He was kind of this ancient version of Bear Grylls, you know, though a little more of the fiery variety. And I get this distinct impression that Esau was more reactive than proactive. His brother, on the other hand, he's a much different kettle of fish or kettle of stew, depending on how you look at it. He was more of a stay-at-home kind of guy. He He was seemingly a quieter individual, preferring to read a good novel accompanied by a decent Chardonnay over skinning a rabbit. His folks named him Jacob, which means quite literally heel grabber. I'd like to meet my son Harry and my son heel grabber. Interesting family. And while he wasn't going to get ahead of his brother by challenging him to an arm wrestle, by sheer brute force, he was ambitious as the day is long. Whatever it takes to win might have been Jacob's motto. I mean, with Esau, what you see is what you got, but with Jacob, he's calm, he's a good talker, he's assuredly charming, and he's going to get what he wants, come hell or high water. I think he was the kind of guy that, you know, after you shook his hand, you'd want to count your fingers, right? So we got this picture of these twin brothers, and then we get an insight into Isaac and Rebekah, and you just know that this is going to get ugly. We read that Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Gee, what could possibly go wrong? This family is going to have a really tough road ahead of it, all of them. In verse 29, we learn that Jacob was cooking some stew and Esau arrives home with a serious hunger happening. He's ravenous. He's immediately aware of the smell of stew. And say what you like about Jacob, but that man could cook. And it sure smells mighty fine. So Esau, he sidles up to Jacob and asks what's cooking. Asks for a bowl of that red stuff because, man, he's just dying for a bowl. And Jacob, knowing his brother perhaps even a bit better than Esau knew himself, he says, you're welcome to some stew if you hand over your birthrights. Now remember, Esau's the firstborn. He's got all sorts of advantages. He's got all sorts of stuff coming his way simply because he's 12 seconds older than Jacob. And he's going to inherit a large portion of the estate, the largest portion. He is going to be the head of the family when Isaac dies. And remember, this is no ordinary family. This is the family that has been given the promise by God that is really far-reaching. This family is pivotal in human history. We had a conversation around our dinner table the other day. There was my dad and my brother, John, and his wife, Maureen, were over visiting, and Tevis and me, we were all sitting there having something to eat. And my brother and his wife, they're moving. They're trying to downsize a bit, getting rid of all sorts of stuff they've accumulated over the years. And this led to a family conversation about inheritances and about family heirlooms. And we realized to a person that amidst all of the stuff that we all had, there really wasn't anything we were particularly connected to. You know, there's some photographs, a few odd items that have sentimental value. But there's no like big ticket items there. And there's no heirloom we're going to fight over, I don't think. I hope. I can't think of anything. So who gets the fill in the blank is not likely to be a staggering issue for us. But boy, that was sure different than Abraham's family because they had the promise of God. And Esau was in line to receive and to steward that promise. And for a mere bowl of stew, Esau gave that up. Now, I have to admit that I'm usually more focused on Jacob, because most of the story that follows is about Jacob and how he goes on to strive not just with Esau, but with God. Jacob is the main character, the one who will eventually get the name Israel. But for a moment today, I just don't want us to lose Esau. Let's pay some attention to him. We heard that Esau he had contempt for his birthright. And he was saying that his only concern was his hunger, that was the most important thing in his life. It's hunger today or some vague promise for tomorrow. This is no issue for Esau. It's just like, let's eat. Let's get focused on today. Here's Esau's problem. It's not that he was hungry, but in fact, Esau had given up on God. God really didn't matter that much to him. I have little doubt that he still believed in God. It's just that God no longer really figured into his life in any real meaningful way. I mean, Jacob, he may have been a jerk. Oh, he was a jerk. At times, he was a most devious and reprehensible character. But at least he understood the importance of the promise associated with the birthright. Jacob actually continued throughout the story to remember the mission. If there's no other thing to keep clear in our minds as we retool and we refocus in the months ahead, it's remembering the mission of the church, because it is just about always the first thing that gets forgotten. It gets usurped by all sorts of other competing reasons for being. And strangely enough, in his own peculiar way, Jacob remembered that point. But Esau, he got so focused on what was right in front of his face, so absorbed by his immediate needs, that he kind of lost track of the future, of what had real and lasting importance. And in going for the quick fix, he lost the most important thing. Our parable today is short and to the point. And Jesus makes up a story about a fig tree that's not producing, and the owner tells the gardener to go cut it down. But the gardener says that he'd be wiser to wait for a year, because he's going to fertilize it. And if it bears fruit, great. And if it doesn't, well, then he'll cut it down. You can call this one the parable of the manure. And it reminds us of the temptation for the quick fix, and how manure is not going to fix something quickly. In his wonderful book called Telling It Slant, the most reliable author and thinker about pastoral ministry, Eugene Peterson, writes this: "It has no immediate results. It is going to take a long time to see if it makes any difference. If its results that we are after, chopping down a tree is just the thing. We clear the ground and make it ready for a fresh start. We love beginning, birthing a baby, christening a ship, the first day on a new job, starting a war. But spreading manure carries none of that exhilaration. It is not dramatic work, not glamorous work, not work that gets anyone's admiring attention. Manure is a slow solution. Still, when it comes to doing something about what is wrong in the world, Jesus is known for his fondness for the minute, the invisible, the quiet, the slow. Yeast, salt, seeds, light, and manure. Manure does not rank high in the world's economies. It is refuse, garbage. We organize efficient and sometimes elaborate systems to collect it, haul it away, get it out of sight and smell. But the observant and wise know that this apparently dead and despised waste is teeming with life, enzymes, numerous microorganisms. It is the stuff of resurrection." So what's important? What's truly important? What smells of the gospel of Jesus? Something that brings life and change and vitality to people's lives. What has lasting value? What's the promise that God has made to us here? Because God's made some promise to us here. And how do we live into that promise? Not just for today, but for tomorrow. And not just for ourselves, but for the ones who God is already bringing into our community life to carry on the particular mission that this congregation is being called to engage. How are we to live into that promise? Amen.